time we were talking about hidden Markov models, and we talked about the problem of decoding, and we asked the question, how do we find, is there a way to find the most probable sequence of hidden states versus finding the overall probability of a sequence by computing, by summing the probabilities of all possible paths. And we said that the solution to finding the individually most likely states is a technique based on dynamic programming known as Viterbi decoding. So today I would like to talk about dynamic programming a little bit just to show you how this algorithm works. And it's really fundamental to a lot of pattern recognition technology. So consider the problem of finding the best path through the discrete space shown to the right. We can visualize this using a grid, though dynamic programming solutions need not be limited to such a grid. They're typically introduced in terms of these kind of best path algorithms, but the process is really general and can be applied to any problem where you're trying to find some optimal path to some discrete space. So what we're going to do is to define a partial path. So we have this starting point here, this ending point here, and we're going to define that path as an n-tuple of these points. So we're going to write the path as a collection of these nodes, the indices of these nodes. So we have s, t, and then I1, J1, I2, J2, IK, JK, all the way out to U, V. Next, we're going to define a cost in moving from points I, K minus 1, J, K minus 1 to I, sub K, J sub K. So we're going to define this cost, the cost in moving from one node to another, as the sum of two costs, a transition penalty, a penalty for making the transition from these two nodes, and a cost of the node itself, the cost of being at a node. So the cost of a transition is expressed as the sum of a transition penalty or cost and a node penalty. And we haven't really said what those are yet. They can be adjusted to produce different types of solutions for this problem. So the overall path cost then, di, j, is going to be the sum of these incremental costs starting at the beginning of the path and summing them up all the way through the path. So we just have the sum over k of the individual costs. Now the principle of dynamic programming was attributed to a couple people. Richard Bellman is one that's most closely associated with this. There's a Russian mathematician, Pontryagin, who's also credited with the simultaneous discovery of this approach. And they kind of approached it from two different points of view, but they arrived at essentially the same result. Bellman's principle of optimality is really what makes this whole thing work. And it states that an optimal path has the property that whatever the initial conditions and control variables over some initial period, the control or decision variables chosen over the remaining period must be optimal for the remaining problem, with the state resulting from the early decisions taken to be the initial condition. Now, that's sort of a mouthful, but what it essentially states is that the overall optimal path, if you think about the overall optimal path here, consists of the individually most like optimal state, so that you can essentially take a partial path and extend it using an optimization algorithm and be assured that that new path is still optimal. And we'll demonstrate how this works, but Bellman's principle of optimality showed that instead of having to do an exhaustive search for all the global best path, you could actually build that path incrementally and be assured that when you were done doing that, you ended up with the optimal path. And that reduces the problem from like an n-squared type search or n-cubed type search to something that's fairly sort of linear with with time. So the dynamic programming algorithm, which is often known as Viterbi decoding, the principle of optimality has a remarkable consequence. We need not exhaustively search for the best path. Instead, we can build the best path by considering a sequence of partial paths and retaining only the best local path. So what we're going to do at a node is to consider all the paths coming into that node and only retain the best path and a pointer that points us to that best path, which we call a back pointer. So at this node, all we need to retain is the overall cost and a pointer to this node. And we can then proceed down the grid and apply this approach. And then at the end, we will be left with the overall best path, and we can backtrack through that path to find the components of that best path. So only the cost and a back pointer containing the index of the best predecessor node needs to be retained at each node. The computational savings over an exhaustive search are enormous. We go from an exhaustive search, which would require something on the order of m to the power n computations, where m is the number of rows and n is the number of columns, to something that's on the order of m times n. The solution is essentially linear with respect to the number of columns or time, which typically we let the horizontal denote time. For this reason, dynamic programming is one of the most widely used algorithms for optimization. It has an important relative called linear programming, which solves problems involving inequality constraints. Dynamic programming is used when you have sort of equality constraints. You have a cost function, typically a quadratic cost function like energy or air, and you want to minimize that. Linear programming is used when your constraints are of the form A1X1, A2X2, plus A3X3 are less than or equal to some value, and you want to minimize this, but you don't have an equality, you have an inequality constraint. Linear programming solutions are also used very widely, and there are some very fast algorithms for doing that, for solving those problems. But for problems where we're trying to minimize the cost using an equality constraint, dynamic programming is the approach. So the algorithm consists of two basic steps. We have an iteration step where for every node in every column, we find the predecessor node with the least cost. We save this index and compute the new node cost. And then backtracking, starting with the last node and the lowest score, we can backtrack to the previous best predecessor node using this back pointer, and that's how we construct the overall path. So the algorithm is pretty simple. We're going to go through an example here. But the nice thing about the algorithm is you essentially just iterate over every node in the grid. And then when you're done, you find the node with the best score, and then you can construct the optimal path just by backtracking. So if you're only interested in the overall score, for example, you've got a set of models, and you're matching those models to some signal, and all you really care about is the model that has the minimum score, you don't even have to do this backtracking to get the path. However, the backtracking piece is useful when you want to actually look at how the data lines up against the model. And that knowing that is often part, we use that sometimes in training systems and such. So let's work a simple example to demonstrate how this works, and then I think the algorithm will be pretty clear. So we're going to do a little string matching algorithm here. Consider the problem of finding the similarity between two words. The two words are pesto and pita. And an intuitive approach would be to align the strings and count the number of misspelled letters. So you might look at this pita and pesto and say, well, the P's look like they should go together. The T's look like they should go together. And then maybe these vowels should go together. And it looks like we have one extra letter. So if we were to think about this a little bit, we might line the strings up like this. Now, if you're trying to, for example, look the word pesto up in a dictionary and determine which word it's closest to, you're going to have to assign some cost or some error to that match so that you can choose the word in the dictionary that's closest to your hypothesis. This is essentially how spell checkers work. Spell checkers don't actually use dynamic programming. They use a faster approach than dynamic programming because even dynamic programming is too expensive when you have 600,000 words in a dictionary. If you've ever wondered how why spell checkers work so quickly, they're actually a very interesting algorithm that's sort of suboptimal, but much faster than dynamic programming. But this kind of a problem lends itself to dynamic programming, and in fact, in the early days of speech recognition, we actually used this kind of an approach. So if each mismatched letter costs one unit, anytime there's a mismatch, we give that an error of one. The overall similarity between these two strings would be three, because we have an error here, an error here, and an error here. Now, another thing that you might think about is whether what we call substitution errors should be more or less expensive than insertion errors. So here we have an extra letter, and you might consider that to be a more serious error, and you might assign that a cost of 2 versus a substitution error where you might assign that a cost of 1. Another thing about this problem, which we'll talk about in a little bit on the next slide, is you might consider the case where the strings do not start and end at the same point. You may have one string which is significantly shorter than another string, and part of the problem is to locate where that string exists in the much larger string. And I'll talk about that later. But for the moment, we're going to work this sort of as what's called a fixed endpoint problem, where we have to start at the beginning of each string and end at the beginning of each string. So let us define a cost function. A transition penalty is going to occur any time we have a non-diagonal transition. We're going to favor transitions which are diagonal. That means, for example, if both of these strings had the same length, there would be zero cost associated for the transition penalty. Because if they have the same length, then you basically sort of line up against each other. A node penalty is going to be accumulate an error of 1 anytime there's two dissimilar letters. So to line these two letters up, for example, is going to give us an error of 1. So we'll use a fixed endpoint approach, which constructs the solution to begin at the origin and end by matching the last two letters. And then, like I said, in a moment I'll talk a little bit about how we can generalize that. Before we actually work it, let's think about this for a moment. You'll notice that this doesn't really allow for some common phenomena in spelling, such as transposition. If you transpose a letter, suppose you spelled PETA, P-T-I-A, it's going to somehow have to accumulate an error of 2, because it's going to have to match the T with the I, and then this T with the, it'll match this I with the T, and this T with an I. It can't really account for transposition. And that's another reason why they use a slightly different algorithm for spell checking. But for the moment, let's go ahead and try to align these two strings using this cost function. So we begin at 0, 0, and we apply our cost function. So at 0, 0, we don't have to worry about transition penalty. We just have to worry about the node penalty. But since the two letters are the same, we accumulate a cost of 0. So what you'll typically do with dynamic programming is you'll keep an array that retains the current accumulated cost. You actually don't even have to keep a matrix. You can just keep an array that's the length of the column. So we'll have a vector here for accumulated cost. We'll note that the cost here is 0. Now, what we'll do next is we will consider all possible nodes here. So, to make things easy, let's start here. So at this node, we're going to apply our penalty, and we're going to say, well, we have to get from here to here. The only way we could get to this node is from here. Since that's a diagonal transition, that will give us a zero cost. And since the letters here are different, that will give us an accumulated cost of 1. So we put the cost here, the total accumulated cost, as 1. We have the cost 0 plus the penalty for these letters being dissimilar, which gives us a cost of 1. Now, let's, as an example, consider another point. Let's consider this point here. What are all the possible ways we could have gotten here? Well, in this particular problem, we're only going to allow transitions from the previous column. So we can transition from here to here. The total cost here would be, well, we now have a non-diagonal transition. So
this is still considered a diagonal transition.
Non-diagonal transitions would be like this or like this. So to get to this point, we could arrive there from here, or we could arrive there from here, or we could have perhaps arrived there from here. So the cost here, to come from here to here, the cost would be 0 plus, we don't have a penalty for this transition, but we do have a penalty for the letters being different. So the overall cost here would be 1. So we go down each one of these points, and we do that kind of a calculation. You look at all possible ways that you could arrive at this point from all these different points, including things like this. We don't actually allow things like this. And you choose the path which has the least cost. So let's continue to this point. From this point, we could arrive at this point from here, from here, from here, and if we look at all the different costs associated with those, we have the cost from here to here, which this is a non-diagonal transition, so that gives us a cost of 1. But the letters here, that's interesting. So the letters here are different, so that would also accumulate a cost of 1. So the overall cost here is 3. The incremental cost from here to here would be 1 plus 1, which is 2. So the additional cost is 2, the overall cost is 3. And then we can do the same thing from here. We can look at the cost in arriving from any of these points and choose the minimum. So we iterate over this this graph, retaining at each point a pointer to the best previous node and the overall accumulated score. And when we're done, we'll arrive at, in this case, since we're requiring the strings to end at the same point, we'll arrive at this final point with the overall cost. And we'll have at that point the overall cost plus a back pointer to the best previous node, which in this case is going to be this node. And therefore, in doing that, in this case, the optimal path is actually the one shown in the dark here. So the algorithm aligns the A with O. It aligns the T with the T. It aligns the S with the I. And it aligns the E. Now the E, because let me restate that. So we align P with P. It aligns the E with the I. Now because we have this horizontal transition here, that's essentially going to be
what we call an insertion. So it aligns the S with that null symbol star, and then it aligns the T with the T and the A with the O. Now, so what we would, if we backtrack from this point, we can essentially construct the alignment. And the overall cost in producing that match was 3, because we had the cost of this substitution, this insertion, and that substitution. Now, it's important to note that this optimal solution is only optimal under the constraint of this penalty function or this cost function. If you change the cost function, you get a different solution. So part of the engineering of dynamic programming is to engineer the cost function so that it produces the behavior that you like. But once you establish the cost function, and once the cost function, there are some constraints on the cost function for the principle of optimality to apply. The cost function, the main thing is the cost function has to be simply a function of the previous score plus the incremental score. You can't have a cost function which is a function of previous events. If you set up the cost function that way, then the principle of optimality applies and you can find the optimal solution. Now, Bellman's principle of optimality and the resulting algorithm we described require the cost function to obey certain well-known properties. The node, for example, cannot be dependent on future events. It's important to remember that the DP solution is only as good as the cost function. Different cost functions will produce different results. Now, there are many variants of dynamic programming that are useful in pattern recognition, such as what's called free endpoint or relaxed endpoint approaches. So, there's a couple popular variants of dynamic programming. One is that you may want to constrain your solution so that it begins somewhere within the first few symbols and it ends somewhere within the last few symbols, but it then has to match the data within the middle. This kind of an approach is typically used when you have a segmentation algorithm that's okay, but it's not great. And your segmentation algorithm, you feel like most of the time the right answer might be within a certain amount of time, maybe 10 milliseconds or 100 milliseconds, whatever your problem dictates. But it's not, your segmentation algorithm doesn't get it down to the sample level or the frame level. So you want to segment the data, then you want to allow some modification of the endpoint when you actually do the dynamic programming. So you can actually program that into the dynamic programming algorithm by allowing these horizontal and vertical transitions so that you can actually produce match symbols in either the reference string or the test string to the null character, which amounts to allowing the data to kind of slide back and forth within the analysis window. Another thing that you can do, and we actually do this in speech processing, is you can constrain the slope of the match so that the slope must be within a certain value. And typically with speech recognition systems, we require the slope to be no greater than 2 or no less than 1/2. That's essentially limiting the amount of stretching you're going to do to match the input waveform to the reference waveform. In problems like audio, where you have a signal that's the result of a physical process, it makes sense to do that because you know that the signal can't change faster than a certain amount of time. Another variant one of the interesting things about the resulting solution is that the path will not necessarily be linear. So when applied to time alignment of time series data, dynamic programming is often referred to as dynamic time warping because it produces a piecewise linear or non-uniform time scale modification between the two signals. This is important for problems like audio or speech, where when you speak fast or slow, you do not simply alter the durations of each one of the component sounds uniformly. Some sounds actually, you don't change their duration much, like the plosives and the stop consonants, things like T's and P's and D's. You can't make a B too long. It's really just always going to be a short B. But some vowels, sounds you will elongate, like ah. So if I talk slowly or if I talk really fast, some sounds are going to be elongated or shortened a lot. Some will be elongated or shortened a little. So you need an algorithm that actually performs this kind of alignment and in a non-uniform way. And that's one of the areas where we use dynamic programming. Another thing that we do with dynamic programming is we can actually allow the endpoints the best path to start anywhere in the input string and end anywhere in the input string. So instead of requiring it to start and end within a particular region, we can actually create a system where if the optimal path consists of horizontal transitions, we essentially consider that as ignoring the reference string and allowing the input string to slide. So we can actually use this to scan data in a continuous fashion, and as long as the current optimal path is horizontal, we consider the data, we are simply ignoring the reference string, and then when the current path becomes non-horizontal, then you actually consider that the match is starting. So we can actually use this in what's called the free endpoint mode to actually segment or to determine where within a model data actually begins and ends. And that's something that's been used extensively in a number of fields, including bioinformatics and such, as well as speech processing. I think that's the last slide on DP. So dynamic programming, you can see it's a very simple algorithm to apply this to the problem, to hidden Markov models. We can essentially take our hidden Markov model state machine, we can display it as a trellis, and then we can apply dynamic programming to find the sequence of states that best matches the input data. And that's why it's used when you want to decode input sequences using dynamic programming. Now, the other thing that that sort of complicates this is that for a very large hidden Markov model-based system, for example, a speech recognition system, where you have 1 million parameters, that if there were no constraints applied, your dynamic programming grid would have to have a column length of 1 million, because you'd need a node essentially for every state. And that's not practical. So what we actually do in speech recognition is we use what's called a Viterbi beam search, which is a suboptimal extension of the Viterbi algorithm, where we only consider a subset of nodes that are most likely. And in this way, we don't have to do a dynamic programming across all states in the system. We only have to do dynamic programming across the most likely states in the system. That kind of thing we talk about more in the speech recognition course, where we talk about practical approaches to doing these kinds of search algorithms. That's a whole area of artificial intelligence known as search, how you find optimal paths through very, very large discrete spaces. And that problem is shared amongst a lot of different disciplines. In robotics, for example, they have a very similar problem when you're trying to plot the trajectory, make a robot go from one point to another. There's a lot of different ways that can be done, and they have to do some kind of suboptimal search to find the solution. Okay, so we've now talked about essentially the process of decoding hidden Markov models, but the remaining thing to talk about are how we can actually estimate the parameters of a hidden Markov model using EM, and how we can generalize the output distribution from a discrete distribution to a continuous distribution. So let's spend the rest part of today talking about that, and we'll probably wrap this up next class. So we talked about evaluation and decoding. We've introduced the forward algorithm as a way to compute the probability of a sequence given a model. We've talked about the fact that we can compute that both in the forward and the backward direction. And we've now introduced the Turbo decoding, which allows us to get the individually most likely states through this graph. Now what we want to talk about is the third problem, learning. How do we actually train the parameters of this hidden Markov model? So what we'll do is we'll derive the learning algorithm heuristically, and then we'll try to formally derive it using the EM theorem. So let's... we've talked about this forward probability, alpha, and we're going to define a backward probability, beta sub I of t, which represents the probability that we are in state omega sub I at time t, and that we will generate the remainder of the target sequence from t plus 1 to t. So this is essentially saying if we're at a particular point at t plus 1, this is the probability of getting to state t, the state omega sub I at time t, given that we have this path explaining the data from t plus 1 to t. So it's just essentially the alphas reversed in time. Now, the key thing in deriving the learning algorithm is to observe that the probability of a transition from omega sub I at time t minus 1 to omega sub I at t, given the model generated the entire training sequence V superscript T, can be viewed as the product of these alphas and betas. We can have the product of alpha from time 1 to time T minus 1. That gives us the component of the path. So think about we're looking at the cost in moving from I to J. And we want to calculate that in the context of the overall path. Well, the overall path consists of what happened from time t is equal to 1 to time t minus 1. Then we have to worry about from t minus 1 to t, and then we have what happens from t out to capital T. So we can obviously write this as the product of alpha sub I of t minus 1, which covers time 1 to t, to small t, beta sub j of t, which covers from t to t plus 1 to t capital T, and then we add to that the probability of transitioning from I to j, which we call aij, and the probability of outputting a symbol at state j, outputting the kth symbol, which we call b sub jk, and then we divide that by the overall probability that the sequence occurred given the model. So these gammas are become very important to the training process, and they essentially represent the overall probability of a particular sequence being observed. But it's done in terms of the alphas, betas, and transition, the specific transition from I to J. Okay. Now this is essentially the probability that you got to state I at time t minus 1, the probability that you transitioned from I to J, the probability that you outputted a symbol, the kth symbol at time J, at state J, and then the probability that you of everything that happens from forward from J from whatever happens after J out to the end of the sequence. Now, this is not, of course, 1, because this is essentially a path that says anything could have happened before T minus 1, anything can happen after T, but for this probability, you must go from state I to state J. You must go from one state to the other state. Okay? So it's not all possible paths, it's a subset of all possible paths. So the expected number of transitions from omega sub I at T minus 1 to omega sub I at T at any time is simply the sum of this over T. So we can take the sum from T is equal to 1 to capital T of all paths that go through state I and state J. And that's essentially what we get with the sum of the gammas. So the expected number of any transition from omega sub I is simply going to be the sum from k is equal to 1 to c of all of gamma sub I k of t. And then again, we have to sum that over time so that we get all possible paths that go from I that somehow go through I. So this is the expected number of times that we will essentially go through the I states. So we can then use these quantities to estimate the transition probability. We can estimate the transition probability for Aij as the ratio of the number of times we expected number of times we take that transition over the expected number of times we could have taken that transition. And we can similarly estimate the output probability density function, Bij, by simply looking at the number of times this happens and the number of times we output the kth symbol divided by the number of times that we enter that state. So so these are estimates for the transition probabilities and the output probability distribution. So the resulting re-estimation algorithm following this principle is known as the Baum-Welsh or the forward-backward algorithm. And it amounts to computing these gammas. As your training data arrives, you compute these gammas, and you continue computing them as you're going through all of your data. And then once you're done, you can form the estimates for the new values of the probabilities using these ratios. You replace the probabilities with these re-estimated probabilities, and then you iterate, you repeat the process. That's essentially, in a nutshell, what the Baum-Welsh or forward-backward algorithm is. Now, there's a big question there. The question is, will this algorithm converge if we iterate in this fashion? We've demonstrated that this algorithm, that it makes sense to re-estimate the parameters this way, but we haven't really shown that if you do this, the algorithm, the parameters will converge to the true values of the parameters. So the process of estimating the parameters in this iterative way, this is what's known as the Baum-Welsh algorithm. The process of proving that this converges to the true solution, this is the EM theorem. We can actually derive this algorithm using the EM theorem. The derivation's a little tedious, but we can derive the algorithm using the EM theorem and show, therefore, that this process does in fact converge. Now, this process converges fairly quickly. Convergence will typically happen within a small number of iterations, even when we're training thousands or millions of parameters. Within about three iterations, you actually get very good convergence. Seeding the parameters with good initial guesses is very important. So sometimes we will sort of bootstrap our system. We'll take a small amount of data, do some training, and then take those parameters, seed the models, and then do some more training. So there are a lot of different strategies for seeding the parameters. In the early days of hidden Markov model systems, we actually used the dynamic programming approach to seed the models. We would use our dynamic programming technology to get a base set of models and then use those models as input to the hidden Markov model process. If in the speech recognition course, we'll discuss in more detail this whole problem of seeding the models. That turns out to be fairly important if you want to get good performance out of a complex hidden Markov model system. And the ways you do that are usually very application specific. But to give you a flavor of that, with a speech recognition system, we're actually able to train the system using nothing but the transcription of the data at the word level. We need to know what words were spoken. And we can take just that information and we can actually train models that represent phonemes and things, units smaller than phonemes. We can do all that automatically. We don't need to have somebody go in and actually align the data frame by frame. We can do what's called a semi-supervised training. In fact, today now, sort of where one of the hot topics in our field now is the fact that we can actually train hidden Markov models on speech completely unsupervised now, just using very large amounts of data. So we're currently using data sets on the order of about 10,000 hours of speech. And we're able to train model parameters without requiring the actual transcriptions of the data. And that's what's called unsupervised training. But we won't really talk about that in this course, but the process of sort of applying this to your problem requires some thought about what kind of reference transcriptions you have for the data and how you feed the model. Now, thus far we've talked about discrete probability distributions because they're a little easier to understand in the context of a hidden Markov model. If you remember, the output probabilities at each state are computed as a discrete probability distribution. We have a fixed number of symbols that we can output at any state. So a discrete hidden Markov model incorporates a discrete probability density function captured in the matrix B to describe the probability of outputting a symbol. You can think of that as some kind of discrete probability distribution. But signal measurements or feature vectors are often continuously valued n-dimensional vectors. You may be measuring the spectrum, you may be measuring the energy, whatever it is, very often your feature vectors are continuous valued vectors. In order to use our discrete HMM technology, we must vector quantize this data. Vector quantize simply means reducing the continuous valued vectors to discrete values using a set of M codebook vectors. If you've not been introduced to vector quantization, we can talk about that offline. But it's just a process of approximating a continuous random variable with a set of discrete points. It's basically all how compression systems work. Initially, most HMMs were based on vector quantization front ends. However, as people began to think about this, they began to think about the fact that it would really be better to directly model these output probabilities as continuous distributions, and then to estimate the parameters of the continuous distribution. So instead of letting B, the output probability matrix, be a discrete distribution, we can actually represent the output probability at each state as a Gaussian distribution, where that distribution is going to have a mean and a covariance. So instead of simply looking at the feature vector as an index and saying, well, if it's vector number 3, the probability is, you know, such and such, by looking that up in a vector of discrete probabilities, we're actually going to let that probability be computed from a Gaussian model where we model that data as being generated by a mean and a covariance matrix, you know, Gaussian model. And to further sort of complicate things, we're going to use a weighted sum of these Gaussians. This is what's known as a Gaussian mixture model. And these models are very powerful because if you think about the different distributions you can approximate by a weighted sum of Gaussians, you can actually approximate a wide range of distributions as a weighted sum of these Gaussian distributions. So this is, in fact, a very powerful way to model data, but it comes at a cost in terms of parameter count. So you can note that this amounts to assigning a mean and covariance matrix for each mixture component, because we have a covariance matrix here and a mean here. If we use a 39-dimensional feature vector as an example, this is what we use in speech processing, and we use, it's not uncommon to use 128 mixtures per state and to use 3 states per phoneme and to use 40 phonemes to cover a language and to use not just the 40 phonemes but to consider the left context of the phoneme and the right context of the phoneme. So 40 times 40 times 40 possible phoneme combinations. You can very easily end up with a system that has 10 million parameters associated with it. If just the covariance matrix alone, if you think about your feature vectors being 39-dimensional, that means you have a 39 by 39 covariance matrix per mixture component. So this is a very powerful model, but it has a large number of parameters associated with it. So there's some obvious things that we do. We make assumptions about the covariance matrix being diagonal. We try to share these models across states, and you can play a lot of different games about those kinds of things and in your discipline-specific courses like image processing or speech recognition, I would hope that you discuss those kinds of things. But for now, we just want to sort of ask the question, how can we actually estimate these parameters? So it's common to assume that features are decorrelated and that the covariance matrix can be approximated as a diagonal matrix to reduce complexity. This is often referred to as variance weighting because we're going to assume that the covariance matrix is simply a diagonal matrix composed of the variances. If this is not the case with your data, one thing that you can do is to pre-process the data through a global principal components analysis or a global linear discriminant analysis to decorrelate the data. And that's something that is often done to reduce the overall parameter count in your system, is to first decorrelate the data and then process it through your hidden Markov model. What's even more interesting, though, is to note that the single mixture component, if you just look at a Gaussian mixture component, the log of the output probability at each state becomes a Mihalanobis distance. And that creates a nice connection between HMMs and principal components analysis. In fact, HMMs can be viewed as a generalization of principal components analysis. And this is a really interesting point that I want to emphasize. If this is our model for the output probability at a state, if you look at this component of that calculation, this is essentially a Mihalanobis distance. It's essentially what principal components compute when we compute a distance using PCA. So what a hidden Markov model can be thought of as nothing more than a mechanism where you can automatically train these Mahalanobis distances for each class that your data exists, that your represents your data. It's essentially a way to discover automatically the parameters of the model, which are going to ultimately represent the means and covariances of the various classes that you have. So what we will often do is we will take the data, we will take our labeled training data, and we will run it through the forward-backward algorithm using a continuous distribution model. And when you're done, you'll actually have estimates of the mean and covariances of each one of the classes. And then when you actually try to assign the data to classes using a hidden Markov model, you will be doing nothing more than essentially computing these class-specific distances using these Gaussian models. So we'll pick this up next class. I'm going to sketch out the derivation of how you actually estimate these parameters using the EM theorem, but we won't go through the full derivation because it's quite involved, but I want to just give you a flavor of how it works. But I do want you to think about the fact that for most of the problems you're working, if you're going to apply pattern recognition today, you're going to be using these Gaussian mixture models. They're very, very common. And you're going to be using the forward-backward algorithm or EM-like algorithms to train the parameters of those models. Okay. I will see you on Wednesday.